WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, coming up on Fresh Air, we're about to hear a very different point of view in terms of loyalty and patriotism from the one that was just presented by my guest Harris Wolford, who was a special assistant for civil rights to President Kennedy. We're going to hear now from G. Gordon Liddy, who said that he decided he had a debt to history, and that debt being to tell the story of his involvement in Watergate. Not to apologize, but to tell the story. So he paid this debt to history by writing a book, Will. Now, the title of Liddy's book derives from how he strengthened his will and overcame his fears. You've probably heard some of these stories, including the one about how he strengthened his will by lighting matches to his flesh without flinching or withdrawing, or how he ate a rat in order to get over his aversion to rats. Liddy was in the Army and the FBI, and became an assistant DA before moving to Washington, D.C. in 1969 to join the Treasury Department. He became the finance counsel for the Committee to Re-elect the President, where he organized the Watergate break-in, designed to bug the Democratic National Committee headquarters. Liddy was sentenced to 20 years in prison. In 1977, President Carter commuted his sentence to 8 years, and he was released in September of 77 after serving 4.5 years. Liddy is known for his loyalty, for his stamina, and his refusal to give information. But since the statute of limitations has run out on his offenses, he's discussing much of what he did. When I spoke with G. Gordon Liddy, I asked him what kind of impression he would like to leave his readers with concerning his personality and his actions and his involvement in Watergate.
You know, it's hard to sum a thing like that up, but if I must, I would say just somebody who did what he was supposed to do when he was supposed to do it, did not do what he wasn't supposed to do when he wasn't supposed to do it. And when I was in the Army, they gave out medals for conduct above and beyond the call of duty, and I don't really feel that I've done anything above and beyond. All I did was what I was supposed to.
So you'd like your image to be someone who was following their call of duty and doing their best in the service of their country and their president.
Yeah, but always bearing in mind that I don't believe in blind obedience. I believe in individual responsibility and freedom of the will and the supremacy of conscience. And I did not and would not do anything which did not accord with those. And I'm also a believer that, you know, when you do something that you think you ought to do and you know it's illegal, and I knew it was illegal, just as the, what do they call them, civil protesters or whatever,
civil disobedience people,
if they wanted to do that, that was fine. But I didn't have any respect for those who then, when they were caught or prosecuted for it, proceeded to snivel. And so I should not be heard to carry on about what occurred in my case. I was perfectly willing to accept whatever the positive benefits might have been from my courses of action, and I was perfectly willing to accept and did accept the negative ones when something went wrong. And I just think that's the way everybody ought to be.
Well, I believe your family worked hard for your release from prison.
Sure they did, yeah. Well, that they did, and they did because they felt that the term of imprisonment was excessive. And indeed, that came to be the position of the United States government. Otherwise, I would still be in.
Do you think it was excessive?
Well, I think so. In terms of the other folks, you know, mine was four times as much. And it has been no secret made of it by John Sirica that the attempt was to break me through doing it that way. And he didn't have a prayer of doing that, and in fact did not. So that being the case, I didn't see much point to it.
What's the point of keeping anyone in prison if there's no longer information that can be gotten from them?
Well, it depends. If you're in prison and you talk to other prisoners, they will be amongst the first to tell you that we still have to have prisons because there are some people out there who are very dangerous to society. And they'll say, hey, I've got a mother, a wife, a sister, whatever out there, and I don't want some mad dog rapist being able to nail them anytime he wants to. There are some people like that who are dangerous and have to be kept away. By the same token, that doesn't mean that the conditions in which those persons are kept has to be inhumane. But there's an awful lot of people in prison who really don't belong there. I think if you've got a victimless crime or a crime against property, somebody takes somebody else's money, I think it would be a lot more sensible from the point of view of society if they had that individual living in a restricted environment such as a halfway house or something, working and paying back the money. I think the victim would feel a lot better at getting his money back or her money back rather than sitting there saying, yeah, he's in jail and I'm not getting my money back, but my taxes are it's $13,000 a year to keep him there, you know, and there's not much point to it because the individual isn't dangerous.
When you were an assistant DA, you organized a number of drug busts, and when you first arrived at the White House, one of your priorities was to try to stop the flow of drugs in the country, and I'm sure many of the people who were arrested served long, some of them short, prison sentences because they were holding marijuana or
I disagree with prison sentences for personal use of a drug like marijuana because there the only one who's being harmed is the individual himself or
herself.
Does
this represent a change in point of view?
No, I support it. No, I supported the people? I supported the revision of the New York law. I said that at one time. New York law was such that if you had a little bit more than a quarter of an ounce of pure sand in your hand and one marijuana seed in there, you had a felony possession. And I was amongst many who recognized that as a pretty ridiculous situation and moved to change it. By, on the other hand, however, I took the position, and I have not changed, that those who deal in drugs and especially those who are in the business of what we would call harder drugs, be it cocaine, heroin, morphine, or any of those controlled substances, do constitute dangerous people because they are involved in the destruction of lives of children. Now, when it comes to marijuana, a dealer, I would say, is a danger because I'm aware of the effects of marijuana, of continued marijuana rather than just occasional experimental use, on goal orientation, things like that, which is critical among youth. And so I would not put in jail the kid who happens to have gotten a hold of a joint. But I would look for people who are selling that stuff to children because they are harming those children.
Okay, let's get back to your sense of loyalty. You were very loyal to President Nixon at the time that you were working in the White House. What was it about Nixon that you felt deserved your loyalty?
Well, I would have felt the same way were I in the service of any president of the United States. One's president is one's commander-in-chief. Whether or not one is in the same political party, I would say that Richard Nixon had no greater claim upon my loyalty than would have had I been in the Army or in the government service during the reign of Franklin Roosevelt, with whom I disagree and was a different party. But he is the commander-in-chief, and so you serve him loyally, or you resign when you feel you cannot any longer do so, such as Mr. Vance just did, which was a very honorable thing for Mr. Vance to do. He resigned when he felt he could no longer support publicly the policies of his president.
Did you feel Nixon was a good president?
Yes, I think he was very, very good, very competent president. That happens to be the judgment of those in Europe and Asia and even in Africa right now, and I think ultimately will be the judgment of history in this country. And as a matter of fact, something interesting happened when I was in Detroit about 3 days ago. In preparation for a show very much like this one, Radio Call-In,